Swami Kriyananda is fond of telling a joke, which many of you have heard before, but it's very apt to what we're talking about today. A man had a farm that was very carefully cultivated, and he was very proud of all the work that he'd done. And a priest came to visit him, and he said, "Aye, this is a great farm that you and God have created together." And the farmer, not wanting to insult the priest, but still a little bit annoyed by that statement, he said, "Well, Father, that may be true, but you should have seen it when God had it all to himself." And that sort of puts forth the dilemma that we face a little bit when we're talking about acting with our own strength, acting with our own creativity, taking responsibility, and yet we have this other teaching, which is also true, which is that everything comes from God. And that, as Jesus put it, we are just branches on the vine of the infinite, and if we don't bear divine fruit, then he cuts us off and throws us into the fire. It's a pretty grim prognosis and makes one rather eager to get on the right side of the question. Although, Jesus also promises that even if we bear divine fruit, God is going to purge us, so we'll be able to give more, which may not also be a really welcome prospect, except the second half, where we'll be able to give more. So there's a great deal here that has to be sorted out and understood if we're really going to live on the right side of this question. Someone wrote to Swami Kriyananda once and asked him, you know, we're supposed to tune into the presence of God. We're supposed to feel God's presence. And the man said, "But I don't understand what that means. How do I feel God's presence?" In the English language, when we talk about God, we don't really have a specific image in mind. You have to go to some church and have somebody like me explain it to you. But I'm only trying to explain to you in terms of your own experience, not in terms of the dogmas that somebody else is asserting are true. As Swamiji says, "I'm only here to convert you to your own self and to nothing else." And that's a very important distinction. But we still have that word God, or we attach the word God primarily in the West, we attach it to Christ. And if you don't happen to be a Christian or devoted to Christ, or if you have had some bad experiences with the church or grew up in a way where Jesus was not necessarily your hero, that's not necessarily a very good idea either. If you grow up in India, God is Krishna, God is Rama, but all of it sort of leaves you where? So when this young man asked Swami this question, he said, it's easier to feel God first in terms of his attributes. In other words, in terms of the manifestation of the divine spirit that we ourselves already have some familiarity with. One of the things I love about the way Swami Kriyananda teaches the principles of self-realization is no matter how elevated the idea, he always tries to find a way to bring it down to something that we ourselves have actually experienced. And then even if we haven't understood the infinite potential of that, we can build from what we already know. This is the great secret of success on the spiritual path, is that we have to stand somewhere where the ground is firm under us. I often suggest to people that in a real sense, you have to back up spiritually. If you can't just sort of look around and know that everything is God, you can't be affirming all the time that that's true if there's no spontaneous resonance with that truth. We have to keep backing our spiritual life up, so to speak, until we're standing on really solid ground. You know, like things tend to work out, or I have the creativity to find a solution, or I have great endurance, and therefore I can accept what comes and know that I can persevere. That might not feel to you like a spiritual dogma, but it's a solid point of truth from which to begin, and then we can add a deeper and deeper spiritual truth on top of that. When Swami Kriyananda, as he has often been asked, because people are often asked, why did God make all of creation? Sometimes we think that the first question we have to have answered is the great cosmic why, and then we'll get engaged in the story. It's kind of a way to get ourselves out of having to put out real effort. Just explain everything to me, God, and then I'll get interested, okay? You know, it's like saying to your college professor, explain to me all the conclusions of this course, and then I'll study the beginning. The college professor says, I'm not going to bother with you. You need to work with where you are, and then you can grow to that understanding. God is not so unkind, but nonetheless, There's real truth in that. It's a way of trying to avoid responsibility. But nonetheless, it's a question that's often asked. And Swamiji's answer was just so beautiful. He said, the nature of God, and then he's defining it in a way we can understand, is Satchitananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, especially ever-new joy. The nature of God is bliss. And Swamiji says, isn't it so that the nature of bliss is to want to share itself? And just, he said, just think, the way we are in our everyday life. You go to a good movie, and what's the first thing you do? You tell someone else. Oh, I just love this movie. I know you'll like it. You find a new restaurant, and they have a wonderful salad. Oh, you must go to this restaurant. I know you'll like it. Here's a CD I made for you of this music that I think is so good. Where does that come from? It's because when we feel uplifted and we feel joyful, it's the nature of that joy to want to spread it out and give it to others, isn't it so? And Swamiji said the nature of the divine is infinite bliss, and God wanted, and the phrase is, to enjoy himself through many. The obvious answer to that is he doesn't seem to be enjoying himself through very many. But he wants to at least give us the chance to have infinite awareness, and that's what the purpose of the human body is to have infinite awareness. Now, I need to try to remember where this started and why I was saying that. What was I talking about? Oh, yes, the attributes of God. That was it, exactly. So, the traditional description of the attributes of God is that there are 8 manifestations of the Spirit. It's a very subtle and a beautiful teaching. And those manifestations are love, peace, calmness, which is different than peace. Peace happens when there's not much going on. Calmness can happen in the middle of a battlefield, in the middle of a great fight. So you have love, peace, calmness, joy, wisdom, light, sound, and energy. Power is how it's often described. The word energy is a little more clear because we tend not to think so much of power, but we can think of energy. Now, we manifest these attributes in one way or another a great deal of the time. We love one another. We feel a spontaneous love for many things in this creation. Do we ever ask ourselves, where does that capacity to love come from? Why is it that I love? We have this beautiful song that Swami Kriyananda wrote, what is love? Is it only ours? Or does love, he says, manifest in the flowers? You know, all of this world that we look around seems to be an expression of some kind of love. There was a rose bush in one part of our community. There's a number of rose bushes in various places. This rose bush stands by itself, and it's near the entryway to our community. And one year, after all the rest of the roses had finished blooming, this one rose, and it was red, had put up one very long stalk. And at the top of that stalk, it had one huge rose on it. And just sort of standing next to that one flower, I could feel that this rose bush had saved everything up, and it waited until the stage was clear, and then it was his turn, just like that. And it was such a sort of conscious self-offering. You know, there's nothing more clear as a manifestation of the divine spirit in many ways as flowers. Yes, flowers have a purpose in the propagation of the plant, but it's hard to say that you couldn't propagate the plant without so much panache, you know? They just have so much going for them. And it really is just a manifestation of the fact that the feeling aspect is also a part of creation. We don't just do things in a utilitarian way. We do them in a way that expresses much deeper states of consciousness. Where do those states come from? If they came from human nature alone, we would all be like that, wouldn't we? But we walk around all the time and you see vast differences in the levels of what? Of attunement is the only word you can think of. People have attuned themselves to all different realities depending on what vibration they're living in. And everything is self-consistent in that way. When we first leased the community, the investors bought the community for us to lease since we don't own it. Ananda doesn't own it. It was a very run-down place, and it was very transitory. It was a transient, I mean, it wasn't a transitory place. It had been there for a long time, but the population was transient. And that was important to us because we knew that we were going to have to have those people leave so that we could move in, and we didn't want to have the karma of really kicking people out from their homes. So the fact that it was run down and was filled with a very transient population was exactly what we needed. But it was so amazing to us. I mean, not only were the buildings run down, not only were the colors ugly, not only was the grass overgrown and the lawn covered with trash, but when we'd go into the apartments, all the furnishings were like brown or black. The carpets were heavy. And then in the midst of everything, the people who lived there kept the curtains closed. In one house, there was actually an entire motorcycle being worked on in the living room. And I mean, I'm not trying to be rude in any way, but obviously these people lived in a universe where brown and black were the ideal colors, and that light was the enemy. You know, one of the divine manifestations is light. But light was the enemy in these people's lives. And unfortunately, to their detriment, their lives reflected what they were attuned with, which is the police came really often, and there was, you know, a lot of drug use and crime and just despair. You weren't looking at ever new, ever conscious, ever new bliss. We would have been happy to give it to them, but they didn't see us. Well, they didn't see us at all. What to speak of seeing us as being attractive, because we were attuned to a very different reality. We were attuned to blue and pink and lavender and wide open curtains and white walls and no automotive things in the living room, you know? It's just a completely different way of living, and we weren't attuned to crime particularly. You know, our concept of life was not, let's see what we can get away with and not get caught. We've been there, done that, really. Been there, done that. This doesn't work really well. We are ready to live according to something else. So all the time in our lives, we're choosing. We're literally choosing from infinite possibilities. Look at the universe, look at the world, look at all the human beings in the world. Everybody's choosing one of the infinite options or a multitude of them. And people live according to what they hear and see and feel in tune with. And then that's what they manifest. Now, the great glory of this, the great freedom of this, quite the opposite of making you feel bound, is that you can tune in, we can tune in at any point to any one of these infinite possibilities. And the only difference between great success and failure, between despair and happiness, is what we choose to attune to and therefore to manifest. Because we are part of this greater reality. We don't exist just all by ourselves. I mean, how many of us really can even, like, the hair starts going gray and you have to go to the hairdresser to get it changed? We don't have the capacity to re-manifest ourselves. In that way, we can assert all this personal freedom, but the fact of the matter is we're always being influenced, even the language we speak. You know, it's so remarkable to just watch how children grow and how they gradually assume whatever it is around them. I was so charmed when this little 3-year-old boy went into his mother once and said, "Hey, Mom, I need a couple of sandwiches," just like that. Like, where did he get a phrase like "a couple of sandwiches"? He just sort of came out with this completely adult way of responding that he just picked up from somewhere. We were coming home from a pilgrimage to India once, and on that long flight home, there were 4 women traveling, and each of those women had 2 little babies with them, little tiny Indian orphans, infants, that they were bringing back to America to be adopted. And it was like a volunteer job that these women did. They would fly over to India and they would pick up these babies and they would bring them back. Each woman had 2. I said, "How are you going to manage?" "Oh," she said, "no problem. The whole plane will help." And she was absolutely right. Everybody else on the plane was so magnetized. And you'd see this little dark-haired child with, you know, totally Indian features. And you'd be introduced to Michael William Smith. Michael William, okay. And you could see how, just from a very young age, this little person, a little body, because it's a full person, is going to be planted. I think they were going to, like, Milwaukee or someplace right in the middle of the country. And you knew that this child would grow up with the face of someone born in India, but would speak American English, have a completely American attitude. And, of course, if that child were being taken to Germany, the child would grow up as a German, even no matter what it looked like. We're just It just depends on what we tune into. Yogananda writes of being an infant when he was first born and just lying in his crib. And he talks about, this is an autobiography of a yogi, it's one amazing sentence. Gradually, out of the confusion of languages going on in his consciousness, meaning all the languages he'd ever lived, ever spoke before, because if we take the idea of reincarnation and that we choose different cultural settings, because you see, each of these cultural settings has a certain bias, a certain orientation that suits our karmic needs. When you travel around the world, it sort of becomes a game. When you go places where there's lots of international tourism, you try to guess before people open their mouth what country they're from, if they don't have an obvious physical defining characteristic. And it's really a lot of the time you can tell without hearing languages. The poor Germans come in for it the most, but you can almost always recognize the Germans. And you can usually recognize the Russians. And often the French have a certain sort of je ne sais quoi about them, you know, just something. And it's really fun. And then, as Swamiji points out, every so often you meet people who are totally beyond their upbringing. They just have no defining characteristics because their qualities were so much themselves that they merely lived in that culture, but they were always tuned into their own magnetic reality. You know, so these little babies are coming to this place, and Master describes there, but that's one of the reasons why we have all these different cultures on the planet, all these different choices. On this planet, and this is only one, Master said, of many planets that we could choose to go to, because maybe we want to be German, because we really need willpower. Swami Kriyananda says, who's taught all over the world, one of the techniques we teach is energization exercises, and by conscious will, we send energy to the physical body, and you tense until the body vibrates with energy. Swami says, in Germany, you never tell them to tense as hard as they can. So it's very dangerous to do that in that country, because as hard as they can actually physically injure themselves with their own willpower. You know, but in other countries, Mexico, for example, you really want them to, you know, tense as hard as they can, because they have the lovely, or Hawaii, places where things are a little easier, you know, where the energy is just, the culture is different. So we choose our cultural influences. People try to explain themselves in terms of their cultural influences, but it's much more interesting to say, why did I choose to be influenced by these situations? You see, why did I choose to be an American Jew? Why did I choose to be of Italian extraction, to be the only black person in a white neighborhood? Why did I choose to have these influences? And often you begin to understand your karma, not because you were those things made you, but you wanted to affiliate with them. Master lying in his crib, as I was trying to say, he said he gradually sorted out among all the languages in his head, the consistent one being spoken was Bengali. So he then began to learn Bengali from his family because of all the choices, that was the one he was supposed to know this time. I read a humorous little true vignette in Reader's Digest from a man who was born into the Berlitz language family, the Berlitz training schools for language. And he was raised simultaneously in five languages, consciously. His mother spoke one, his father spoke another, his aunt, his grandparents. You know, so five languages were being spoken to him all the time. And when he was, and he would just answer everybody for a long time in whatever language was spoken. Swamiji was raised in three. He was raised in English from his parents, Romanian, because that's where he lived, and German, because the nurse, the nanny who took care of them, was German. Swami said for a long time he spoke German as well as he spoke English. But Romanian was the language that was spoken primarily to the servants in the household. And when his mother accidentally spoke to him in Romanian once, he was slightly offended. Mother, that's the language of the servants. Like that. And that's how he had it in his mind. But this boy in that family, when he was about three, he decided that what was going on, obviously, is that every individual in the world had their own personal language. So no matter what language was spoken to him, he would create, out of an amalgamation of all of these languages, his own. And he would just answer them back, thinking that was finally what was being asked of him. And it was only, you know, slowly they managed to persuade him that wasn't the truth. Because we try to figure out among these influences. Now, more profoundly than language or culture, the influences that are really being offered to us at all times is the choice of consciousness. Because the one consistent feature in all of the countries and languages and cultures that we speak is that we're dealing with self-awareness. Isn't that true? I mean, we're self-aware. Master in the crib was self-aware enough to figure out he needed to talk to these people, so he began to listen to how they were talking to him. A little child, these little Indian orphans coming over to grow up in Milwaukee, are going to look around and see what people do here in Milwaukee. And he'll learn to play baseball, and he'll learn to like cartoons, and you know, he'll learn to eat hot dogs or whatever it is that people do. And he sort of gradually picks all this up. But what is the theme behind that? It's not the food or the music or the sports. The theme behind that is self-awareness. The theme behind that is my own consciousness of my existence. How do I experience it, and what do I express? And all of these superficial aspects are just manifestations of my state of awareness. And this is where the eight manifestations of spirit become so critical. Am I expressing love or hatred? Am I expressing joy or unhappiness? Am I expressing calmness or agitation? Am I expressing wisdom or ignorance? Is the sound that I'm attuned to the infinite harmony of the universe? Or am I, by my voice and my actions, constantly creating dissonance? Is my very presence an experience of uplifting light? Or does everything I do, am I drawn to the darkness, and is that what I'm trying to express? And this is the way in which we literally become instruments of the divine, or instruments of the not divine is the only way you can say it, or let me say, a shadow across the face of the divine. It's very interesting in Yogananda's poem, Samadhi, which is his verbal description of cosmic consciousness, which the pictures, the illuminated panels on the wall are from that poem, and the whole poem is in the back. And the first line of this is how, when Yogananda went into the state of infinite awareness, that all of creation dissolved in front of him. And he says, vanished the veils of light and shade. And what he's saying is the duality of this world went away when he transcended it, the veil over the truth. But he called it light and shade. It was a very interesting statement. He didn't call it vanish the veils of light and darkness, because all you have is light, and then you have something that interferes with that light and creates a shadow. But light is the operative and infinite and unchanging reality, but we can shade that light by not allowing it to penetrate us, or by being too dense a force. And so all of these divine states are the underlying reality, but if we choose, we cannot perceive them. Or you might say there's the source of light in one place, we can turn our back to it, or we can go so far away from it that it appears that it has ceased to exist. But it doesn't. It never can. And all that happens in this creation, no matter what culture, what planet, what language, what reality you're living, we are living, is that the infinite Satchidananda simply continues, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss, and it literally just waits for us to figure this out. And we do figure it out. It takes us a long time. It takes us a long time in one lifetime, or it takes us over many, many incarnations. The good news is you get to keep trying. The bad news is you get to keep trying. You know, you just shedding your body doesn't do anything to change your consciousness. It just puts you in another context, like going to another country or getting a new body and having to figure out what the language is supposed to be here. Because it is our own nature, Satchidananda. We are manifested from that. And it's just up to us whether we bear the fruit that we were destined to bear, or whether we entertain ourselves with lesser experiences. And it's our own nature that drives us. Isn't that so? Again, just to bring something very cosmic down to something very small. Isn't it our own nature that constantly drives us? Oh, that restaurant was good, but I hear that this one is better. Oh, this dress looks nice, but it would look better if it were changed a little like this. I think I'll do something different with my hair. I mean, where does it come from? It's because within us there's this ever-expanding desire to experience in whatever way we think is possible something that is more satisfying to us. Even those people living in our complex when we bought it, I mean, it seemed like a good idea to them to live in brown, brown, dark, dark, windows closed. I mean, they didn't do it because they said, oh, let me see if I can make myself as miserable as possible, even though, in fact, they may have been doing that. And the man who, you know, tries to steal instead of trying to work, he thinks that's a good idea. I visited once in the local jail. A man called us who wanted some help with meditation because there he was in jail and he thought it might be a good idea, which it was a good idea. And it was the first time I'd ever been into a prison, and it was just like a movie script, this San Mateo jail at that time. It was like there were these holding cells with bars in the front, and you went down a big echoing hallway, and everybody in the cells stood at the cells because something was happening, you know, you, and they held the bars and they looked out like this. And I walked as close to the dead center of that hallway as I could, you know. After a while, because we visited him there and in other prisons, I got more accustomed to it and I wasn't quite so freaked out. But that first visit, I was freaked out. That's the only word for it. But it was also amazing to sort of see the consciousness of these people, because you could see, again, with all due respect, that they hadn't been reformed. They'd merely been caught, you know. And it was almost like physically they were pushing against those bars, but when they got out, they were not going to be different. They were just going to push against those bars and run one more time to whatever it was. It was going to take a little longer. It was also amazing to me because they were behind physical bars, but all of us are behind bars. We're behind the bars of the limitation of our own desires and our own thoughts and our own misunderstandings. Sat Chit Ananda. That's where we're going. That's who we will be at the end. But right now we're up against pushing, and we still think that there's going to be another alternative to a manifesting peace, love, calmness, wisdom, infinite light. We think most of the time. But then, you know, early in the morning and late at night and every Thursday and maybe on alternate Saturdays and maybe for a whole month at a time, I think I'll just be resentful and angry. How about that? Let's try it. And in this one case, I'm justified. Or we do it reverse. God loves everyone, but of course not me. You know? I'm the one exception in the whole infinite. All sins will be forgiven except not mine. You know, however we look at it. And then when we do that, the infinite spirit, totally unaffected by it, the same way that the sun is not affected by the very dark curtain that we put over it. When we do our school plays in here during the day, in order to create the effect of theater lights, we put this blackout paper over all the windows. It's an astonishing effect. Just black out all the windows. Feels like night in here, but it isn't. It just feels like night because we've created shade where the light was. And we can keep doing that. And God will keep just cutting us off and throwing us into the fire. Not because he doesn't like us, but because it's not enough. If your little child is perfectly content, you know, just to be in diapers forever, you know, there's a certain point where you know this child has to learn not to be in diapers. One of my friends was trying to encourage her son, "Don't you want to be a big boy?" she said when he was refusing to be potty trained. "No," he said, "I like being a baby." So she wisely decided that maybe it wasn't time to train him. But we were all confident that he would eventually learn. And he did, of course. Because at some point, he was ready. And that's how God works with us. And even when we begin to bear divine fruit, God says, well, that's good, but that's not enough. Because fortunately, we have a loving divine mother, just as many of us were gifted to have loving human mothers and human fathers who said, that's good, dear, but your potential is greater than that. And then push us a little harder. So divine mother and heavenly father, which is such a sweet way to think about it, says, that's good, dear, but your potential is greater than that, because we are ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss, and nothing less than that will ever satisfy our own hearts. Bless you.